Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why AI may be coming to curbside recycling.
And the next installment of the Chef Talk series visits a Food Network star in his Scottsdale restaurant.
But first, next year marks the 50th anniversary of Guadalupe, the small town nestled between Phoenix and Tempe. Guadalupe occupies less than a square mile of land, and it's home to about 5,300 people, many of them Latino and Pascua-Yaqui tribal members. As the town enters its sixth decade, it's facing a looming disaster. It's just a few years away from going broke. Arizona Republic reporter Sam Kamak has been reporting on Guadalupe's budget crisis. He wrote recently that as things stand, the town will run out of money in 2031. But as Kamak told me last week, this situation is nothing new. In fact, back in 2018, the town manager predicted that Guadalupe wouldn't even make it to 2023.
Ironically, COVID saved the town. Once that hit, the federal money, COVID relief funds came in, and that gave the town a little bit of wiggle room and kind of delayed the impending financial collapse. But now that money's run out, and so the clock's been reset, but it's still ticking.
Yeah. So help us understand why Guadalupe is having this difficulty in paying their bills. What is it that they are spending too much money on, and why isn't enough money coming in to cover that?
I mean, there are a lot of different factors that go into it. When I went back and looked at their budgets, I saw that their staffing costs had gone up substantially. And it's such a tiny town, and its workforce in terms of the town staffers is very small. I think they have about 18 full-time employees right now. But between 2020 and 2024 this year, the town employees got three back-to-back raises, and it substantially increased the cost of keeping the workforce on board, which almost entirely comes out of the general fund. And the increase in spending on employees is about $1 million, which is about the current deficit that they're facing. And then in terms of why they're not able to fill those coffers and cover those costs, it's Guadalupe does not have a ton of different revenue streams for its general fund. It mainly relies on sales tax revenue, which isn't totally unusual, but the town is so small, there aren't many businesses, mostly residential. So a lot of the times, the residents who live there, their sales tax dollars will bleed out into other communities. Like, you know, they can drive some of them 5 minutes down the road and get to malls in Tempe, or go do their grocery shopping at a Walmart in Phoenix. And there is no grocery store inside of Guadalupe. So their sales taxes from the purchases that they make outside of Guadalupe, they go into other cities' accounts. They don't go into Guadalupe's funds. But at the same time, even though Guadalupe isn't really able to fully capture all of their residents' sales tax dollars, or a good enough share of it to break even, Guadalupe has to pay for services for those residents, just like that normal towns would pay for.
Right. So one of the other things that you point out in the piece, though, is that one of the reasons that a lot of these salaries have increased so much over the last few years is in a town this small, there is a need to pay people in a way that will incentivize them to stay in the community and do their work there rather than leaving to go elsewhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Guadalupe, I think reasonably, is worried about retaining employees and being able to hire people like their town manager, Jeff Kaluga, who's working for a salary that is far, far lower than what he could get working in any of the neighboring cities.
So far, we've been talking about some sort of practical things that any community would face, you know, wanting to make sure there's enough tax revenue coming in. Are there any specific challenges economically that the town of Guadalupe faces that might differ a bit from other towns in the valley?
Another big thing is that they don't have a property tax, which typically in let's say Tempe, they have a primary property tax, which everybody pays, and that goes into the general fund. And then there's sometimes a secondary property tax, which voters have to approve. And normally what that does is allow a town to take on debt to fund infrastructure projects. And then the town will use that secondary property tax to pay off that debt over a period of, it's usually like 30 years. Mm-hmm. But instead, Guadalupe, they fund those infrastructure projects out of their general fund. So that's just another drain on an already overstretched,
right?
Like I said, a primary account.
Yeah. But then I could also imagine from the standpoint of, you know, being a resident of Guadalupe, the lack of property tax could conceivably be a big part of what enables people to stay there long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And the community seems to, based on people who I've talked to, not be super on board with a property tax. But the town, in order to continue functioning, needs a property tax and far more afterwards.
So, yeah, let's talk about, like, how, if at all, does it seem like Guadalupe is going to be able to address this over the next 6 years? I mean, what's on the table and what seems feasible based on what you found?
Well, one is that property tax. That isn't going to happen until at least May of 2026. The town council voted to push it back. And then the other kind of workable solution that's on the table is for the town to pay off its public safety pension system debt. The town recently came into some savings because it got, I think it was about a $500,000 grant, one-time grant from the county to do some of the infrastructure projects that it would have, you know, otherwise had to pull out of its general fund. So with those savings, according to the town manager, Guadalupe should be able to pay off its public safety pension debt, and that will save a significant chunk of cash because if the town pays it off all at once, they don't have to make interest payments. So those are two really workable things. And if those happen, the yearly deficit will shrink to about $500,000. So that still leaves Guadalupe in a tricky spot.
Yeah.
And from there, it's not totally clear what the town does to tackle that. The town manager has talked about economic development, but there really is not much open space in Guadalupe for example, a grocery store.
And I'm realizing as we're talking, I don't know the answer to this. What happens if a town just can't pay its bills?
Well, there are a few different things, but the most likely, the town could sort of deincorporate, which, you know, would essentially mean it doesn't become it stops being a town, and mm-hmm. it might become part of the county, which is kind of how the situation was before mm-hmm. 1975. And then, you know, if that were to take place, then the residents would have less control over what happens inside of the town because they wouldn't have their own governing body.
Right. To go back to the property tax example, that could put them in a situation where all of a sudden houses that they've lived in for decades, they have to start paying much higher tax on and might not even be able to live there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible depending on what the county would charge in terms of taxes, what they would be responsible for. I mean, hypothetically, they could be absorbed into one of the nearby cities, but, you know, that's, again, just speculation. And I don't know what that would look like, but I'm pretty sure that Phoenix and Tempe both have primary and secondary property taxes. So that's a far ways away. They do have time to sort out a fix before disaster happens.
All right. Well, that is Sam Kamak, a reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks.
A new pilot program is using artificial intelligence to try to improve recycling. Bloomberg reports a couple of cities, one in Michigan and one in Canada, have equipped their recycling trucks with cameras and AI-powered computers. They're able to identify items in recycling bins that are not actually recyclable. If they find something, the resident gets a postcard in the mail showing them the item that shouldn't have been in the bin. Advocates say steps like this can help people make sure they're only throwing recyclables in their blue bins. Critics, though, worry about privacy, among other concerns. With me to talk about this is Michael Mahaffey, a faculty associate at ASU, where he teaches a class called Sustainable Urbanism. He's also a researcher in sustainability at Notre Dame. And Michael, first off, what do you make of this pilot project?
So I think this is a really interesting frontier. You know, everybody's talking about AI, of course, and I think what this particular project shows us is how we might be able to use AI more effectively. You know, this is early days, of course, but use AI more effectively to help us make good decisions about how we use energy, how we use resources, how we get around, how we, use the city in a more livable way.
It seems like this is one of the big challenges in recycling, which is people putting the wrong things in the blue bins. Maybe inadvertently, maybe they think this kind of plastic or this kind of cardboard can be recycled in a particular city and it can't be. Is this the kind of thing that you think will make an appreciable difference and lead people to only put recyclables in the recycling bin?
I mean, it could be the jury's out. We need to wait and see. But, one of the problems with recycling is just what you say, that people don't necessarily put the right thing in the right bins, or sometimes even if they do think that they're recycling, it isn't really going to get recycled. It goes, it gets shipped overseas somewhere, something like that. So I think these kinds of tools could be really useful in educating us about how we can make better choices, and maybe save some money too, in many cases.
I'm curious what you make about the concerns that some people have raised about privacy in terms of, taking photos of what's in your bin and sending you a postcard about it. Like, do you have concerns about privacy with a project like this?
Well, obviously, with AI and with all computer technology, we've got to be really concerned about privacy, and we've got to have those safeguards. The bigger lesson here, I think, is that with AI and with all of these technologies, we can't just turn it loose. We can't let it just start, doing things to us in our lives. We need to have the human being controlling the process, controlling the technology. And that means the people who run it, but also means us as consumers.
So in a situation like this, with this kind of project, where would you like to see humans being involved?
Well, certainly at the level of the people who are administering it, again, you can't just expect AI to be an automatic technology that you turn over and let it do its thing. We need to control these technologies. So certainly the people who are operating these kinds of programs need to be in the process all the way, curating the results. In addition, I think there needs to be peer review. There need to be checks and balances, and agency review, if it's a private entity or if it's a public entity, another entity that's reviewing it. We need to have these checks and controls on this technology as it's rolling out, especially now in the early days when we don't understand all the different ways that it can be used and can potentially harm us.
So one of the advantages that proponents of this kind of project are talking about is they're using it in one of the cities is East Lansing, Michigan, where, of course, Michigan State University is. And their argument is, among others, is that, every year you have new people coming in, living here, not really knowing what the rules are, not knowing what's recyclable. And then after a year, maybe two or three, they leave and you have a new, batch of students coming in. So I wonder if maybe this kind of thing could be more applicable in a place that's kind of transient like that. I'm wondering, you teach at ASU, like maybe this would be good in Tempe, but maybe not in another more established type place where people aren't leaving quite as much, or even maybe just particular neighborhoods within a city.
Well, with any technology, there's the early adopters, right, that are going to try it out, and I think students are prime for that kind of early adoption process. This is very much going to be an incremental process developing technologies like this. So, absolutely, I think ASU would be a great sort of test bed or laboratory for this kind of project, and then maybe it would become more widely available and more useful to more people.
How big of a dent do you think something like this could put into the issue of the wrong stuff going into the blue bins, which, as we know, can sort of gum up the works at the, transfer stations and in some cases kind of ruin batches of perfectly good recyclable stuff?
Well, this is one of the things that, of course, we've got to do when we're improving our systems, like recycling systems and, making them more efficient and so on. This is all part of the broader effort, sometimes referred to as smart cities, right? Where we're using this kind of technology to identify where the problems are and how to fix those. That's what we're trying to do. But I think we also have to recognize that it's not just one thing, one effort like recycling. It's a whole series of things that have to work together as a system. You know, there's not a silver bullet like, oh, if we all just recycled, everything would be fine. You know, we've got to do a whole series of things, and then all those small things add up to effective change in dealing with our challenges.
Well, and similarly, is it safe to say that within the world of recycling, it's not one thing like this that will make it more efficient and effective? There's got to be other things that go along with it as well?
Absolutely. You know, it's other kinds of efficiencies, reusing things in the home, for example, repurposing things, buying things that you don't even need to recycle because they last longer and so on. Yeah, there's a whole host of things that I think we can become more aware of. And I think AI has the capacity to lead us, to show us, you know, as not as a something that's forcing us into anything, but that's giving us choices, giving us options, and allowing us to see how those can be beneficial to our pocketbooks and to our lives and quality of life, all those things. I think this is really promising, actually.
All right. That is Michael Mahaffey, a faculty associate at ASU, where he teaches courses on sustainability. Michael, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time for the latest edition in our series, Chef Talk. Here we sit down with a chef each month from fine dining rooms to nightclub kitchens and find out what makes them tick. Today, let's head out to North Scottsdale, to the swanky tables of the Americano, where Chef Bo McMillan can often be found these days. McMillan is one of the most recognizable chefs in Arizona. He's reigned supreme on the Food Network's Iron Chef. He's competed more than a dozen times on Guy's Grocery Games. He even hosted Worst Cooks in America. In Arizona, he headed up the restaurant at Sanctuary on Camelback Mountain for 23 years before leaving in 2022 to open Cala in Old Town Scottsdale. Now he's revamping the Americano with celebrated upstart chef Peter McQuaid. But while his talents in the kitchen have brought him fame in the culinary world, he told me it is all about hospitality to him. And it has been since he was a kid and got his first job in a kitchen.
I think I was around 14, 15 years old. I was kind of getting in trouble in school. I had a little ADD action going on and stuff. So a friend of mine, his uncle owned a restaurant in my hometown, Plymouth, Massachusetts. It was a little cafeteria-style restaurant. And my guidance counselor was like, can you get a job and go down and work for this guy from like 1 o'clock to like 5 o'clock, you know? And it kind of saved my life because it got me out of school all the time. I was getting in trouble and losing interest and, you know, distracted. And I came down into an environment where I was like, I was working on the job, I was getting paid. But I was also surrounded by things that were like really creative. I was a busboy when I started, but I was intrigued by the food. And the food was as simple as can be. I'm from New England, a little town, you know, clam chowder and hot dogs. You know what I mean? It was like, that's basically what it was. I just asked as many questions as I could. And I was kind of saying, hey, can I work in the kitchen? And I knew from there that I wanted to do food, like be around food. And I also had it from my grandmother and my family. My grandmother was like the ultimate hospitality person. You know what I mean? So like I learned that. Every year at Christmas, I saw how much someone worked to try to please someone else. And I was just like, man, this is a free gift. But the effect that you can have on somebody from literally just caring and providing something and nourishing them, you know what I mean? And I just witnessed her, you know, her cookie making for like 4 days before Christmas and the holidays, you know what I mean? She waited on people hand and foot. And I thought, I mean, this is the life. This is literally the life. And then, you know, when you can take a recipe and put ingredients together and actually come up with a result, I was hooked.
So it's interesting that you approach it from like a hospitality standpoint, because I think most chefs I talk to think about it in terms of the food. Yeah. But it sounds like you do both. Like this is about the experience. Yeah. It's about how you present it as well.
I don't think food is enough in this day and age. I want it to be at its highest level. And this is a pressure-packed job. People in this job, to make it in this industry, they gotta work very hard. They gotta start at the bottom. It takes years of dedication. It takes years of practice and the skill set. And, you know, I think of myself, of where I am. It's really, it's about mentoring now in this stage of my life and giving. I've seen the light a lot, you know what I mean? I've had my share of wins and all the stuff. The other side of life is taking that step beyond and making sure there is real good hospitality, taking the time to invest in your clientele, but also in your staff. That's listening, that's hearing what they want. That's, do they like this dish? How does this sell? You know, what are they coming in for? And giving them what they want. I never tried to make the food about me. It had some of my expression. It had some of my, you know, my flavors that I loved. It had some of my things, but it was just a track record. It was just a test for what works and what doesn't work. And it was first grade math. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. I wasn't, you know what I mean? It wasn't hard, not rocket science.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think that's fascinating. Okay. So let's talk about the food though, and the flavors that you love and the inspirations that you bring to the food. Talk a little bit about where the food memories that you started talking about with your family and your grandma and going to Quebec and like what she cooks at holidays come to play.
Great. I'm an ADD dude. Like, I can't remember people's names that I met. People in my family, I have five kids. I'm like, what's that one? Lennox or Bo? Is that one, you know, whatever and stuff. But I can remember, like, in movies, a time in a movie where this happened. It's with food. Like, if we went out to dinner 15 years ago, and I remember what you ordered. I remember what I ordered. I remember, because that's just what my love language is. It's just what speaks to me. So I was in Maine. I was maybe 6 years old. My mom, her boyfriend at the time, had a big cabin up in a little town called Dover Foxcroft in the middle of nowhere. We went up to Dover Foxcroft, the cabin. I picked like 20 barrels of the biggest blueberries and freshest wild blueberries from Maine that you've ever seen in your life. And they had an ice cream maker that was an old school wooden crankshaft ice cream maker that you filled the ice up, you put the salt in, you put the blueberries in, the cream, all the stuff. Yeah. We made it. It took us like 45 minutes of churning whatever to get this thing done. And I remember tasting the blueberry ice cream at that moment when it was done, and my life had changed. So that, to me, when I talk about food and I talk about the emotions of food, is really like, you know, how well you take this seriously. Like, you know, every little bit matters when you think about food like that. And what's crazy is now I try to coach young people. And everybody looks at it. And the way I've looked at food so much is like, it's almost like it's not when there are ingredients left to add, it's when there's nothing left to take away. Food at its simplest. So I think like that's where I've kind of rooted in, is like, think about the textures, think about your sensibilities. Don't lose track of what a great day looks like, and when the wind blows and the sun's out, or in the fall, or the smells of cut grass in the summer. Like, don't lose your nose. Like, use your eyes. Like, understand your palate, the bitter, sweet, salty, sour. Like, even textures alone and the balance of textures can give you as much stimulation as a flavor can. This town I got to in 1998. I was 27. I worked the same job till I was 53. I watched it grow up. I think this city can put saute pans down with any city in the country. I think you can eat out here 7 days a week and you can get incredible experience. We just got a James Beard Award winner with my good buddy Renee at Bacanora. We've had multiple winners. Tarbell's has been open for 40 years. Chris Gross is six generations, and Vincent, a pioneer in this restaurant. His restaurant's been open for 30 some odd years. Look at Vincent's. Like, come on, people support the people in the city that are throwing it down. And I love it about this town. I really, truly love it about this town. I cut my teeth there, and it's a place I call Hole, and now I got three different little things going on, and I want to have three more.
I was going to ask you about Phoenix and ending up here, because it's so different from where you started, right? And it doesn't get the kind of credit that in New York or in LA or Chicago will get in the culinary world. Where do you see your role in it? Where do you want to take it?
Yeah, it's, you know, for me, I feel like I've just been blessed to be in the right timing for the right city. I never thought I'd end up in Arizona. I remember getting a job interview here, and I was like, Scottsdale, Arizona. This is 1998. I was like, what the hell's in Scottsdale? Tumbleweeds and cactus? I was like, what am I doing there? That's a true story like this. I'm like, no, I'm just flying out for the weekend. And I got out here, and I'm like, I'm never leaving. I'm never leaving, and I never left. You know, it was a point where I was a young chef de cuisine working under my mentor, Chuck Wiley, at the time, to becoming the mentor and having young people come up and grow up through that process. So it's like, it's kind of a circle, you know? At the end of the day, I hope people would say, you know, Bo did everything he could to champion this community in food and also the chefs that are in it, because I know a lot of these chefs in town and a lot of them have called me here and there, and I've always made it a point or a mission in myself that I've had all this success. I've kind of been lucky and blessed to have the things that I've had. And it could happen to anybody, but I want it for everybody. I'm that guy that's not the cup is half empty or the cup is half full. I'm the guy that's the cup is running the F over. Like, you know what I mean? It's overflowing. And you got to share it. Food is about sharing, right? It's communal. So I want that for everybody in this town that comes out and works in this industry and busts their ass.
Okay, actual last question, because I always ask every chef in this series this question. What do you cook at home? Do you cook at home?
I do. I cook at home. Let me think. Sunday night, I had some friends over, and I bought a ribeye, a whole ribeye, but it was a Wagyu, American Wagyu ribeye, and I cooked that. And stone crabs are in season, so I cook stone crabs. I'm one of those guys that, like, to be honest with you, if I'm cooking for six people, there'll be enough food for 20. You know, with my five kids, there's five different palates there. You know what I mean? And I cook, sometimes I cook three meals. Sometimes I try to believe in myself that I'm going to cook this one meal and everyone's going to enjoy it, which never happens. But I'm simple. I'm steaks. I still love a great baked potato. I love cooking on my green egg in the backyard. Give me skirt steaks. Give me all of that stuff. And it's simple. If I'm not doing things that are going to take me 3 to 4 hours. I'm prepping my stuff out fast. I'm going to get good ingredients. I'm going to cook it. That's it.
Lucky family you have. All right, Chef Bo McMillian, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. I loved being on. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A detective, an archaeologist, and a general. This is not the setup to a joke taking place in a bar, but rather three of the protagonists on the pages of a new book. Disturbing the Bones is a collaboration between journalist Jeff Biggers and film director Andrew Davis. It's the debut novel for the latter. It follows a Chicago detective, an archaeologist working in the Illinois town of Cairo, and a retired military general. I spoke earlier with Davis, who's from Chicago and has directed movies including The Fugitive and Holes, and asked where the idea for this story came from.
Well, it evolved from several different places. First, I think, was a study that was done by Northwestern University of an archaeological site in southern Illinois called the Coster Dig, D-I-G. And they found 26 layers going back 13,000 years in one campsite. It was the most significant archaeological find in North American history. The floodwaters had preserved this incredible history of these people. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. I said, what's the metaphor for what they're going to find from us? And I thought about our missile silos and our bunkers and all the things that may cause us to not exist on this planet anymore. And then I had a friend who was working for the University of Illinois at one time, one of my mentors, who's the guy who worked for the state of Illinois. And he took me down and I saw this dig site and I got very excited. And then later on, I made a movie called The Package, which was a story about some generals who didn't want to have a disarmament agreement happen between the Soviet Union then and America. It was Gene Hackman and Tommy Lee Jones. Mm-hmm. And I integrated the story of this confrontation about missiles and this archaeological find and wove in a kind of in the heat of the night type of a story to it, which was involving the history of infamous Cairo, Illinois, which has a dark past in terms of racial issues. And in the southernmost part of the Union Army where Grant's headquarters were. And I wove these three together. And now I have an answer that's much longer than you wanted me to give.
Well, so that actually leads me to one of the things I'm most interested in, which is the difference between writing for film and writing a novel. Like I would imagine there are some similarities, but some things that are pretty different.
Well, you have much more freedom with the novel. Mm. Because you can add all kinds of texture and details and backstory that it's very hard to do without making a 10-hour movie. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, you know, you have to be eloquent. You have to write in a way that's got a kind of sophistication and charm, which Jeff Biggers helped me with a lot.
What was the research process like to write this book as opposed to, for example, writing a movie?
Well, I had been working on this idea, I just realized, for many years. Jeff and I met 10 years ago, and I had been thinking about this for maybe 15 or 20 years.
Wow.
In terms of just the setting and the story and the dynamics. And so we started working on a screenplay and decided that we wanted to put so much in it. Let's write the novel, and then we'll extract the best for the screenplay. But Jeff did a lot of great work about archaeologists and about what was going on in the history of Southern Illinois and about military bases. There's a military base near where the story is set, where we monitor the Russian missiles. And this is part of our story now, you know, so things sort of evolved together. We just went back and forth with giving each other ideas and leads.
Do you anticipate that this will be a film at some point?
Well, that was the goal initially. I hope we can. The business is pretty crazy right now, but if I get the right cast, maybe we can make it.
All right. So I'm curious also about the fact that this is set near your hometown. You referenced that you're a guy from Chicago. Obviously, you know, you worked on The Fugitive, which also had Chicago ties to it. Is there a significance of including your hometown, your community, as maybe one of the characters in the story?
Well, I think locations are always characters in movies, and certainly they should be in a book to give it a real sense of texture and visualization. Jeff knew Southern Illinois. He knew the Cairo LA area, you know, Carbondale and the Shawnee National Forest, where this is set. His family was from Kentucky across the river. So yes, I think location is important. I'm sort of known as a Chicago director, and having the details of the city affecting the ethnicity of the characters. We have an African-American cop, 60 years old, who lost his mother when he was 14. Randall is his name. And there's an archaeologist who's a young girl from Cairo. Molly is her name. And so, you know, it's something that comes with reaching into the soil and in the buildings and the streets to get these characters to come alive.
So do you anticipate that you are going to continue writing novels? Like, did you like it enough that and find it fulfilling enough that you want to keep doing it?
Wow. You know, it's the creative part was terrific. The collaboration, developing the relationship with Jeff was great. I don't really enjoy having to promote my own stuff. You know what I mean? And what I understand is writers are responsible for letting the world know. I mean, you know, there's very few writers who get a budget in the studios, when you're promoting a big movie, they do it all for you.
Yeah.
At least in the old days. Now there's so much out there. You know, when my films would open, everybody knew The Fugitive was opening that weekend. You know, you didn't have to wave a flag too much, you know. There weren't that many movies coming out that people wanted to see. So today it's a different world. There's so many distractions and everybody's on their cell phones and watching things on stream. It's a big job to promote a book, and I'm very grateful that I can talk to someone like you to help get the word out.
All right. That is Andrew Davis, a film director and writer. His debut novel is called Disturbing the Bones, written along with Jeff Biggers. Andrew, thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. As the daughter of leukemia researchers, Dr. B. Krause is no stranger to serious illness. She grew up with a deep understanding of what comforts people at the end of their lives, and as an adult, dedicated her life to providing whatever help she could. As a student of both psychology and music, she has found a unique career path as a hospice musician. She visits with patients at Casa de la Luz Hospice in Tucson, offering musical performances on the harp, which she has been playing for decades. I spoke with Krause earlier this year.
I have a great big fat folder of music, meditative, religious, popular, etc., that I bring. And often the patients are not conscious. Other times I'm able to ask. And sometimes if someone is really dying, you don't want to bring them back with something familiar. You want to really give them something unfamiliar and meditative and let them go. I do have some go-to songs, and one of them is the Sky Boat Song. Historically, it was a lullaby sung to Bonnie Prince Charlie after he was wounded in battle, and he was put into a boat, and he was rowed over to the Isle of Skye. And if you hear this song, you can almost hear the oars dipping in the water.
Can I ask you about that detail that you just shared, which I'm very fascinated by? If someone really is at the end of their life, that a person in that moment, it wouldn't be helpful to play something familiar to them, but rather to play something more meditative to help with their transition. What is the reasoning there?
The reasoning is music is so interesting. It hits more parts of the brain than speech. And it evokes memories and it evokes imagery. And if it's a familiar song, it will bring somebody back. And if it is completely kind of arrhythmic, unfamiliar, it is in harmony with letting go.
So if somebody is really about to pass away, a familiar song wouldn't provide comfort, but would actually create a kind of resistance.
Yes.
Wow. Your research and your work with folks in hospice is particularly focused, if I'm not mistaken, on veterans. What have you found the particular desires or needs of veterans in those circumstances to be?
One of the things that happens in hospice, your defenses are down, you're looking over your life, and PTSD, if you experienced it before, reemerges. And the other thing that happens at end of life for veterans is something in the literature they call moral injury. You may have done things during your service that were against your core values or seen others do them, and you're coming to the end of your biography and you want to end it well. There was a case recently where a veteran was talking about things that happened during his service, and it wasn't clear whether he was just an observer or he was involved. And he said, "I'm very grumpy. I'm remembering horrible, horrible things."
Oh, God.
And I asked him if I could play America the Beautiful, and he said, "Oh, please, oh, please." And I did. And his dialogue changed. It changed to the band of brothers and sisters who helped each other. It changed to what he was really fighting for.
Well, it strikes me as we're talking that I'm just going back to what you said about music striking more parts of the brain than speech. They have had experiences that those of us who are not veterans can't fully comprehend with our rational minds. And so it makes a kind of intuitive sense that a language that can access more regions of the brain would be necessary to really channel their experience.
Yes. I'm going to go a little psychological on you.
I'm ready for it.
There is a nerve called the vagus nerve. It attaches to the inside of the eardrum and it goes. It's called vagus because vagus means wanderer. And it goes everywhere. It goes to motor centers. It goes to emotional centers. It goes to the fight or flight or relax centers. It goes. That's why you tap your toe when you hear music, because it goes to the motor centers.
And that's why there are certain pieces of music that affect us emotionally in ways we weren't expecting, I'm guessing.
Yes, absolutely.
Can I ask you, Bea, do you find that in times in your life when you have been dealing with grief or loss or the imminence of something terrifying that you turn to music as a form of comfort?
Absolutely. I'm a widow myself.
Oh.
And I have to say that friends gave me a certificate for massage, and I went to get that massage, and I happened to get it from the lady with the largest collection of CDs I've ever seen in my life. And she talked to me a bit about what was going on in my life. And she says, with your permission, I will play this. And it was a song called The Land of the Leal. And it was about a husband knowing that he was going to die and telling his wife, Jean, that she had done her good duty and they would meet again in the land of the Leal. And Leal means that which is true and good and faithful. And she played that thing for me. And not only did my muscles relax, but my tear ducts filled up. And it was very, very, very healing. It was like my husband saying, you done good, B.
Oh, that's a very beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. B. Kraus, a certified healthcare musician at Casa de la Luz Hospice Inpatient Unit. Thank you so much for this conversation.
You are so welcome.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.